This is Lekka. I'm Lucy Dillon. Welcome to the first Lekka episode of 2024. Yes, I know it's May at this point. I decided to take a little break from the podcast at the start of the year as, to be honest, I've been quite burnt out recently and it made sense just to have a little rest and come back renewed. And that renewal, that break, ended up being a little bit longer than anticipated. But I'm back now. Thank you for being here with me. I've noticed there's been a few new listeners and subscribers over the past couple of months, so I'm really delighted that you're joining me, and I'd love to know what brought you here. I had a real spike in listeners at the start of the year, and I couldn't figure out where it was from. So if you can help me solve that mystery and let me know how you found out about the podcast if you're a new listener, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Instagram at Lekka Podcast, or you can get in contact via the Lekka website. That's at lekkapodcast.com. Speaking of my burnout, it's probably a good time to mention that if you are in a position to make a financial contribution to the podcast, you can do that on Patreon, Substack, or Apple Podcasts. They all cost in the region of about £3 to £4 a month, or you can save a little bit on the monthly cost if you pay for a year's subscription. You'll get access to some subscriber-only content, and more importantly, your support helps make the production of this podcast more sustainable and essentially possible for me. I really want to continue making Lekka as long as I possibly can because it brings so much to my life, but it's really helpful to me to be able to cover my costs like website hosting, music licensing, equipment, and taking a fee for my production. It just makes a huge difference as it means I can focus more on Lekka and less on my other freelance work and can make better podcast episodes, essentially. I've actually got some cool subscriber-only plans coming up this year, including a new monthly essay series called Scraps, which has just launched. The first edition is about the Ideal Home Show and it's available for everybody, so you can have a little trial of it there. The audio series I'm running there at the moment for paid subscribers is wrapping up this month with four really interesting conversations to listen back to about food packaging. That's called Out of the Box, and you can find that on Substack, Patreon, and Apple Podcasts, as I mentioned. And if you're not in a position to pay for this, that's totally fine. Thank you for being here as well, and I'm so grateful to you for listening as well. One of the best things you can do to help me that costs nothing is to spread the word about the podcast. So if you like it, tell a friend. I'd be really grateful. And one more thing before we start. If you're in or around London, on the 15th of May, I'm speaking at a super cool conference at Conway Hall, which is in central London, called Interesting 24, organised by Russell Davies. It's a series of short talks about interesting things. My interesting thing is obviously to do with kitchens, which will come as a surprise to no one. If you'd like to hear me do a 10-minute talk about kitchens alongside loads of other great speakers, get your ticket. I'll put the link in the show notes. Okay, finally, on with the show. This month on the Lekka Book Club, Piglet by Lottie Hazel. I first came across Lottie's writing when she contributed to the first Lekka zine that I curated and published in 2019. Plum Jam, a piece of short fiction about a funeral, an underset blancmange, and a broken tooth. I still remember how the piece unsettled me, placing complicated family relationships alongside difficult or reluctant pleasure derived from feeding others, or being fed by them. Lottie's debut novel, Piglet, came out earlier this year, and its writing is deeply rooted in what food can mean to us, physically, emotionally, and socially.
I didn't want food to be like a benign good. Sometimes cooking can be a relief and a meditation, but that is a percentage of the time. And I just wanted it to be pervasive throughout the entire text to kind of manifest all the emotions, because that to me felt more honest.
I love talking to Lottie about Piglet so much. As you'll hear us talk about in the episode, I found it such an interesting experience to encounter such luscious, detailed writing about food in a fictional setting, particularly set alongside scenes of abject discomfort. You'll know what I mean if you've read it. The book really made me squirm in an intriguing way, and I loved how the dishes and tablescapes that Piglet makes and consumes dressed the set of her home and work lives. Heads up, if you haven't read the book, we do talk about specific plot points in it, so if you'd prefer to be spoiler-free, go away and read it first. And the book does touch sort of somewhat implicitly on themes of body image, weight, and some implied references to disordered eating. So if those topics are in any way sensitive to you, just please take care with listening. We began with Lottie giving us a quick Piglet synopsis.
I describe Piglet as a story of appetite and aspiration, and it follows a woman who is nicknamed Piglet in the couple of weeks before her wedding. And in the days before she's due to be married, her fiancé confesses this terrible truth to her that threatens to unravel the life that she has really carefully curated for them both. And we follow her in the countdown to the day they're to be married, and we follow her unravelling and her trying to digest this truth. Food pun not intended, but inevitable when I'm talking about this book. And we see lots of her kind of grappling happen through the lens of food, which is really important to how she perceives herself as a person and how she perceives others.
And so how does she perceive herself as a person?
I think their class comes into this in a big way in terms of Piglet comes from kind of like a working class, I suppose, family from Derby, and she is doing her best, I think, to distance herself from those people. The book doesn't really present us with any information why she would be doing that, besides the fact that her family have nicknamed her Piglet, and we assume that has a level of complication and pain attached to it. But it's more a case of we meet her when she's in a very aspirational part of her life. Like, Kit and his family are kind of like middle upper class, and she's trying to assimilate. And lots of her food behaviours are, you know, lavish spreads, expensive pieces of meat and wine and alcohol. So I think that's all part of her perception, is that she is kind of affluent and worthy in the context of her mind compared to her family, I suppose.
I definitely want to come back and talk more about class in a minute. But just to come back to the sort of writing of the book itself, when did you start working on it?
So I started working on it in 2019 when I started my creative PhD, which looks at contemporary food-centric fiction. So I just was like, what would I really like to research for 3 years and just have a great time? As if I was allowed to do that, it's wild. And I was looking specifically at narratives of disclosure and how food can be used in kind of an experiment of satisfaction with the reader and with the prose. So I started writing in 2019 and really hit my stride when I was allowed to go nowhere like everyone else in 2020, and finished it in that year.
And so what were you looking at in your PhD? I remember hearing the title of your PhD or reading it somewhere and being like, oh my God, that sounds incredible.
I had a really wonderful time. I was trying to answer, or at least explore, the question of the kind of satisfaction cycle. So specifically in literature, and specifically when food is used as a device, not necessarily. I think there are loads of wonderful books that use food that aren't necessarily foodie fiction, or like, I think Piglet is pretty foodie, but I think food is such a wonderful tool to explore, you know, class, gender, social dynamics, familial dynamics. It's just so ripe for creative play. But to circle back to your actual question, I was trying to work out how disclosure could integrate with a novel that used food to offer kind of levels of satisfaction or release or kind of unclenching for the reader. And so in Piglet, I'm really trying to run Kit's confession and how much we know about that as a reader alongside Piglet's appetite as it grows, and kind of ask the question of what's satisfying.
How have readers responded to the fact that, and I don't know if this is a spoiler, maybe it is, that we never learn what Kit has actually done? Have you had people being like, why don't we find out?
Mostly really well. I think my publishers have done a really good job of positioning the book, because I think that if it was packaged differently, you might think it's a kind of like a will they, won't they romp about whether they get married, and or maybe it's kind of more of a crime thriller. So I think they've done a really good job in setting up the expectation that I'm not going to necessarily follow the contract that is set out between the writer and the reader at all times, and that's kind of by design. But I have also had, I had another one yesterday, quite a few irate Instagram DMs being like, I've read the whole book and it's never said anywhere what he does, so can you please like chop chop, what's going on here?
Do you know what he does?
Yeah, I feel like one of the guests at the wedding in a way, and looking around at everyone on my table like in a gossipy sense, being like, do you know what it was? Oh, it could have been this, and speculating. And in some earlier drafts I did play with putting a labelled ending in, being like, this is what he did. And I read them, I was like, this isn't better for me to put my suggestion in there. And I'm so much more interested in the collaboration that I can have with everyone who reads it, in that they bring so much to the text. I am really motivated by the blank space and the invitation that leaves.
Yeah, that's such an interesting way of looking at it. When you said it could be a crime thriller, it made me realise how unambitious I'd been in my imagination about what he could have done.
Yeah.
I was like, I just think he's obviously just cheated or something, but no, it could have been a murder.
It is fascinating to hear people's like level of the scale of speculation is wild, and it's been one of my favourite things, I think, doing the press for the book tour, to be like, okay, when it was acquired, the publisher who acquired also publishes Lee Child, and Lee Child's editor was like, it's murder, right? And everyone was like, that's too much Lee Child for you. No more.
And so you talked about how food is such another great food metaphor. It's a really kind of, it's the writing of a book with food positioned in it is ripe for experimentation. And I think that was one of the things that really struck me about Piglet, is like how central food is to the kind of general world building, if that's not too cringe a phrase. But I kind of did an experiment when I was just like recapping, because I read it a couple of months ago, and I was just like flicking through the things I'd underlined before we spoke today. And basically every page that I stopped at had a, and that was, you know, I was, then I started stopping every few pages, and every single page had something about food on it, which is kind of extraordinary. Can you give me some examples of some of the ways in which food is completely central to the book itself?
Yeah, I find that very hard to answer, because I feel it is the book itself. I feel like there's not a element that it hasn't touched. I feel like when I'm thinking, I suppose the main things that I was trying to explore where I feel food is wonderful at illustrating that are things like the gender expectations that surround women, but specifically at the wedding, which I think the body plays into that as well, and the physical self. And I think food does so much in that space, both in the kind of like the woman eating, but also the woman being perceived to be eating. So that was a big one. I think also kind of social frictions, like the things that different people find acceptable or worthwhile to eat. So I've spoken a lot about Viennese when I've spoken about Piglet, and the kind of importance of that as a, I think, social and cultural touch point, and how people, different people react to that. Funnily enough, I found out that Viennese in Canada is apparently a really like high-end, like very posh thing, and I was like, we didn't do the sensitivity read for Canada. We've missed a trick.
I do think it's really, because Viennese is such an interesting like British class symbol, and I think when you, I did write this down, that there's a line about they only serve Viennese ironically, which I just think like encompasses so much about British food culture and like class and like the kind of obsession with wealthier middle class people often having this kind of like obsession with working class culture, and almost like a cosplay weird cosplay thing. So yeah, I do think that I can see why you've talked a lot about it, because I think it says so much to us.
Yeah, but I also think it underlines the kind of cruelty. I think that there is, for Piglet, I think there's a cruelty that she thinks so freely in that sense, that she serves a Viennetta ironically, because it's so much of a, not only is she rejecting those familial customs, she's also refashioning them into something to kind of like step on them and to lift herself up. And I think it's kind of like, I think it's kind of in conversation with what you're saying about the cosplaying, but there is a kind of sinister element. It's like, haha.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, she has to make it clear that she thinks she's better than it in some sense.
Yeah, which I think is, for me, part of the reason why I loved writing her, because it's part of the sadness for her character. That it's like, you're missing out. Like, her family fail her in lots of ways and she fails her family. It's, I think that I like writing characters that no one is the front runner of the good person. but I think that she really misses out there. She misses out on Viennetta and she misses out on a closer bond with her family. But, you know, it's complicated. They call her Piglet and that's obviously been damaging.
Yeah. Like you say, nobody is the front runner for the good person. Yeah. Like, nobody comes out covered in glory. That is one of the really interesting things about it. I also find the kind of dynamic between Piglet and Kit and how food kind of like exists in their relationship. And the example I noted down was when, and I can't remember, I guess maybe this is after he's made the disclosure to her. I actually can't remember, and you can probably correct me on this. But it's when he's making the porridge for her and she's basically, because she normally makes it, like she's very, the kitchen is very much her domain and she has specific ways of doing things, and that's how she kind of expresses most of her emotions, really.
Yeah.
And Kit basically does the porridge wrong. And I really related to, I saw myself in this in a really negative way. I have definitely been guilty of what she does, which is that he cooks it, you know, it's too hot, it burns, it's the wrong texture. Like, it's very like Three Bears. It's not the perfect thing. And that's really interesting because it felt to me that that was her way of having power, like within the class struggle between the two of them, that doesn't really need to be there, but is nonetheless. Like, would you say that's a fair reading?
You're right, it comes after the confession. And interestingly enough to me, I don't perceive Piglet and Kit as having a conscious class struggle. I think that she is with his family. Okay. I think that reading's totally valid, and I think that surely it must play into their relationship as well because of who they are and the way they've been shaped. But for me, that scene is it's kind of a domestic tension and fraughtness. That's what I was thinking about at that point, was purely kind of the, I suppose, the land grab game of the kitchen, of, you know, Kit's tentative and I suppose quite brave decision to inhabit that space, because when you call that behaviour out, it's totally unreasonable. But so I also feel like it's so understandable why she feels so angry at that point, because it's kind of all that is, all of her anger is manifesting via the porridge, and, you know, he's betrayed her and also he makes terrible porridge and life is bad.
Yeah, I found it fascinating how, like, Piglet basically can't get away from food. Like, it's her, you know, it's her hobby, it's her social life, but it's also her job. So I guess I'm interested in, did she always work in publishing for you? Was that a central part of her as a character?
Yeah, she always worked in food, and there was briefly a bit of catering, but she moved quite quickly into publishing because, firstly, I have experience in that, so I'm like, I can be detailed here as much as I want to be. But also, I think there's something kind of equally foreboding about someone that knows how to package food to readers. And especially in the food publishing industry, there are so many diet books or, you know, various books that aren't necessarily about enjoying food and enjoying the sensation of it as an eating. It's, you know, coded and complicated. And so I thought that was a interesting kind of sideshow to be going alongside that. But I also felt that her monetizing something she enjoys feels very present and very contemporary and very relevant, to the extent where it's like, well, do I like this anymore? Or have I just, have I ruined it? And, you know, now I've made it my entire personality, well, but relatable. I can't get away from it. Yeah. I feel that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, we can't win.
No.
Piglet can't win. So maybe if we could just come back to, I know we've talked about it quite a lot, but just to kind of talk explicitly about food and class in the book. I'm curious, it really, this sort of reading it really made me think about my own experiences as somebody that definitely grew up middle class, but there is, like, it's just so nuanced. And like when I moved to London, I just had this completely different experience. I was around people who had this completely different experience with food. Like, the only time I'd eaten pesto, like, up until the age of like 18, was like in a supermarket salad buffet. And that was just because that was what existed around me. And like, I think you're kind of like, how class and food interact in your life is dependent on so many things. So I guess I'm curious if this isn't too personal a question, like how your own experiences kind of impacted how you wrote about it in the end.
Yeah. Oh, I think totally. But I think that if you ask, like, if you ask you that question, for example, you know exactly what I'm trying to say, because I think to a degree we all have that journey of however our kind of like culinary horizons expand once we leave the home, they do expand. And for Piglet it's a class journey, and I think for most people it's some level of my parents or whoever was feeding me have, they didn't do this and I'm doing this and I'm exploring it. I think it's kind of like the folly of the child, of the younger person, of the younger generation, to be like, I am so aware and cultured and, you know, whatever.
I am discovering.
Yes, precisely. And also, yeah, that's totally my, I think has lots of roots in my experience as well. Like when I went to university, I liked to eat, but I wouldn't say I was a kind of explorer of the culinary world. That sounds so terrible, doesn't it?
No, I know what you mean.
Yes, I'm one of the dickheads who is being like, I'm so refined and interested with the food I eat. But yeah, but I think it's kind of like an unavoidable, I think that must happen to everyone in some capacity, even if it's just, you know, you're eating a different type of, I don't know, bread or whatever it is. You don't always eat the same things you've eaten growing up.
Yeah. Do you know what that is? That is so true. And I think, I feel like you're making the point, and yeah, again, correct me if I'm wrong, that it doesn't really have to be about class. Like it sort of is for lots of people, but it also, that is often because we are poisoned in this country to just be like, everything is rooted in class. So
yeah.
But you're right. It doesn't have to be about that. It can just be about a different experience.
I wonder if there is a way, I can't think of an example where it wouldn't be about class in some way, because I suppose the quote bettering of the self by eating a wider diet, whatever that width is, maybe that always has a class kind of element to it, even if it's something that's, you know, that doesn't seem to be particularly coded in an upper class way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, but that is the interesting thing about, I think, British attitudes to many foods is that, and I don't want to get too kind of stuck in a rut with this, because I feel like it's something I could talk about all day. But like the idea that, you know, buying a takeaway coffee is like the liberal metropolitan elite that, you know, belongs to that. And it's just so ridiculous that like, there are so many countries that have these amazing rich food cultures and it has nothing to do with class. Everyone eats well. And a curiosity about food is a positive thing rather than seen as this kind of like desire to prove you're better than others.
Yeah. But also I think there's kind of like a very sinister rooting in the division of peoples as well. It's kind of, it has a political edge. Like if there's the liberal elite drink coffee and eat avocados and they're, you know, ruining the conservative, you know, I could go on but I get you entirely.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've touched on this already, but another thing that was very present in the book is the kind of relationship between eating and the body, which sounds like a really basic thing to say, because obviously there is a relation, there's a very clear relationship between eating and the body. But that was where so much of the discomfort in reading the book came for me, kind of reading about this. Yeah, and it really kind of struck a chord for me, the idea of we're not able to separate the kind of like public perception of our physical body from what we eat. Like it's kind of always on display and it's always under scrutiny, particularly for young women, like not to oversimplify, but that is the truth. And like the very fact she's called Piglet is immediate, just immediate kind of like it, you know, it gave me a real like cringe, like inside, like not in a kind of awkward, just like, oh God, like imagine having that nickname. That's awful.
Yeah.
And you know that even though if it does come from a place of affection on some level, it's also
it's still horrible.
I feel like people would know the impact of how that would feel in the society we live in.
Yeah.
There's not really a question in that, but I guess, I'm just interested in, how it felt to write about the body in that way, as well as the food. It was very, very much positioned alongside each other.
Essential, I think. It felt essential to write about that. And I think all the things that you've just very eloquently outlined were things that I was thinking about. It was the fact that as an individual, especially as an individual in a female body, there's a level of power that has been wrested from you, that you don't get to choose the way you move through the world in its entirety. And no one does, I'm sure, but it feels like a particularly compromised position in relation to women and food. So my key goal for Piglet was for her to be able to use her body in a way that felt powerful to her. And that power isn't necessarily a positive thing. We see her struggling with, I suppose, ordered food behaviours. But I was very keen not to label those things as, quote, bad, because I wanted her just to reclaim a sense of, power and agency via the body, even if that is unsustainable for her.
And even if that is, in some sense, quote, socially unacceptable.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess. Yeah.
But also, like, I'm really fascinated by that socially unacceptable. I think that plays into the whole question and the kind of issue of the writing, because, like, why is it? Why? There's some extreme, more extreme, quote, eating behaviours in the book, but still, if you're a passerby, you probably don't witness all of it, I think. But I think there's a level of discomfort with the idea of women that eat. And I just wanted to put on that string and see how far that would go.
And I feel, you know, Piglet is very much aware of the potential for shame around that. And one of the most uncomfortable scenes for me was when her colleagues find her in the restaurant alone. And I just, the kind of like level of exposure gave me like a sort of full body horror. And I think that it made me reflect a lot on how I think I have some of my sort of thinking and behaviours around food about, like, something I very much keep private, because it does just feel so exposing to that. I was like, I never would have sat in the restaurant and had 7 burgers. Like, I would have just got them.
You take them a takeaway, Don't be an idiot.
But that felt really interesting, that she kind of didn't mind being perceived in that way, but it was just when the worlds collided and people that she knew saw her doing it, that's where the shame came in. And I found that, really kind of illuminating in a way.
Yes, it's interesting that she kind of walks the line of, like, she kind of courts the attention when she's anonymous. But as soon as she named, it's like, oh, dear God, I've melted into this. I have to go and die now because I cannot come back.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about the croquembouche, which is the wedding cake that Piglet chooses to make herself, which is an unhinged thing to do at the best of times, which it is not. Why a croquembouche?
There was a kind of irresistible pull to the French cuisine for the wedding. I think it says lots about Piglet as a kind of aspirational person. In the book, we discover that Kit's parents import foie gras from France because it's obviously illegal in the UK. And I think there's the commitment to, I think it's just a commitment to assimilation and to showing off. It's a look at me opportunity. And irresistibly, because it's a dessert you traditionally smash, I was like, when we get to the end of the book, like, I need someone to take a baseball bat to this. And I thought, I just like the inverting of the, let's smash it together and push one in each other's face to destroy it.
Yeah. I think for me, it was kind of, obviously, like, it's like you say, it's a construction that is very durable in a sense because it does need to be smashed in, but there's also this like innate sense of fragility because it's such a complicated, delicate thing to make, and it doesn't go to plan. Like her making of it, there's kind of this like, it ends up being this sort of like ersatz grog and bouche, which I thought was really, one of the bits I really liked about this kind of, you know, this thread was her family getting involved in the making of it, which felt actually really sweet in kind of a horrible situation.
I think the croque en bouche is really, it's kind of a metaphor for Piglet herself. It's an overreaching for no reason. Like, there's no reason to do this. And when Franny comes in to try and help her with the glue gun at the end, and it's like, no one cares. And I find that really tender as well, just to be like, this, let's get ready, you crazy lady.
And again, like, not to make it all about me, but I have not made a croque en bouche, but I definitely related to that idea of when you actually break it down and you think about something, you're like, I'm entirely doing this for myself. This is only for me.
Yeah.
And this is only because I want people to say to me, aren't you so clever and brilliant? Look what you've made.
100%. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. This is something we've definitely touched on already, but I was so fascinated by how these beautiful descriptions of food that you kind of wrote throughout the book, you know, like absolutely gorgeous table spreads of like wonderful meats and like plates and salads and like really like delicious descriptions of food. And they sort of sit in this very uneasy place alongside like pure disgust. Like one of the lines I wrote was, you describe the artery on a cigarette packet as like a skirt steak oozing yogurty plaque. And I just thought it was so interesting to bring, like, when you say that food touches on everything, is that what you mean, that it's not just the food itself?
Yeah, that is a particularly disgusting description, isn't it? That is a terrible one.
Isn't it? It's so visceral. Yeah, I can see it immediately. And like, that's also kind of like, you know, a huge part of, we all know what you're talking about. Like, we've all seen those packets. And,
Yes, it is kind of what I mean when it touches everything. I think I didn't want food to be like a benign good. Like, I never wanted it to be like, when she interacts with food, like, you know, the weight lifts and, you know, and she's good and her mind can float, because I just don't perceive that to be truthful. I don't perceive, sometimes cooking can be a relief and a meditation, but that is a percentage of the time. And I just wanted it to be pervasive throughout the entire text to kind of manifest all the emotions, because that to me felt more honest.
Yeah, that your use of the phrase benign good there is that, yeah, that is so accurate, I think, because I do think that is how food is portrayed in so much writing about it. And I think it's kind of seen as this very like cozy. But we can't ignore the fact that there are so many internal and external factors that bring discomfort to our cooking and eating.
Exactly. But even when it's cozy, like, why is it cozy? Are we thinking about a childhood and, you know, a dead parent or an absent, you know, absent parental figure? Like, why? I don't think it's ever, it can feel good, but I don't think that good feeling is ever without depth and something to explore.
Yeah.
And I think that was really important for me for writing a female character as well with a food interest, that she isn't a benign good. Like, her feeding of people isn't selfless. It's very selfish. She's getting so much from it, and it's not the nurturing and kind of feeding of others that is her primary goal. Yes.
And I think what I really liked about the way that you wrote that is, again, it's not a bad thing. It's not a negative thing or a positive thing. It's just, it is what it is.
Yeah.
She's a product of her environment.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was writing, and generally when I'm writing, I just want to try and put words on the page that feel like they're truthful. And that feels like a truthful thing to me. Like, I relate to that. Like, when I make, you know, a big lunch with friends or family, like, I enjoy doing it and I enjoy eating the food, but also I enjoy being like, look at this, look at it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
I think it can be very easy, given the conversation around this idea of like food as servitude. And obviously, you know, for some people it is, and that's fine. But it made me think about what I actually do get from cooking for people.
Yeah.
And that it is selfish.
Yeah.
And that is, to an extent, fine.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely fine. Also, I'm kind of like, I'm not that interested in food as servitude. I just don't, I don't want to, I feel like it's just not a particularly interesting space to explore. I don't think that it's, I think it exists, like you say, but I just don't feel like that is contributing anything particularly interesting. Like, if Piglet was just a, you know, a kind of browbeaten person.
Well, I think it's that it comes back to the gendered expectations, doesn't it? Because I feel like food as servitude is something that was expected of women in the home for so long. I mean, maybe servitude is the wrong word there, but it was an obligation. And actually, like, maybe, because I, you know, I've kind of talked about this and stuff I've made before. I have like a bit of a weird relationship with how much I enjoy domestic aspects of my life, because it feels like regressive in a way. Like, I can't separate it from feeling like I should want more than this.
Yeah.
But actually, positioning it as something you're doing for yourself
makes
it very different. And I've never quite thought, I've never quite thought about it from that angle before. So that's something new for me.
That is so true. But it is hard, isn't it? Because we all live in this conditioned environment where it's like, do I like cooking because I've been told or because I like it?
Oh my God, my eternal, my eternal dilemma.
Yeah. And then does it matter?
Do I like it? Because, people can see me doing it and I'm showing this great image of what can be done in the home.
And then it's like, well, we are. I'll just enjoy the feeling.
Yeah, maybe we make ourselves feel bad enough of the time.
Yeah.
Have you ever written non-fiction food writing? I was curious to ask you.
I have, but not particularly good non-fiction food writing. I used to, like, in the mid-teens, what do you call that decade? Who knows? Like, I did some food blogging, but it was mostly terrible.
I relate. I feel like often the novels that I've read in the past, and there are so many exceptions to this that I could immediately sort of prove myself wrong by saying this, but I think there is this perception as like people who write novels about food are people who've come at it from this, like, the idealized place that we were talking about. And I think I'm really interested that you've primarily sort of professionally used food to create fictional worlds. I think that's a really unusual, in a sense, place to come from in this. And it, because we're so used to reading the sorts of descriptions and writing about food that is in Piglet, that for me, like, felt very familiar in a non-fiction sense.
Yes.
And so that was really interesting to me that it was fictional. And I don't quite know how to articulate why that feels significant, but it does to me.
I think I understand what you mean about, because in the novel, for the most part, I was attempting to put as few words on the page as possible and be really sparse with my descriptions. But when we got to the, when it's in the food sections, that's where I tried to let the writing bloom and kind of exhale and take up space. And so maybe that is, I don't know, maybe it's the relief that's the sense of relief in that, in those passages, that allows a sense of goodness, whereas in the rest of it I'm being very, or trying to be, kind of fraught and tight and withholding.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Maybe that is what's coming across to me. I think it's also just, it's unusual or uncommon. I don't know what the best way of putting it is, but I don't read that many books where food is talked about with such like passion, but also nuance. It's not just creating. You're not just using it to describe a great party, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking about the kind of commonality of food writing that is mostly positive. And maybe it's more of a publishing trend than it is a writer preoccupation. I think so much of what we read is dictated by what people want to publish, which is, you know, a very small sect of people that are trying to sell books that have sold before.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's very true.
Not to be too depressing about that.
No, but it's fair, isn't it? Like, as much as we want to see it as a kind of, we want to see publishers as like patrons of the arts or patrons of culture, at the end of the day, many of them are just publishing what sells the most.
Yeah, yeah.
And so our expectations should be lower. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's that complicated position of being both, where it's like, I want to, but equally,
yes,
I also
yes,
want my
so
bonus.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is like, that's how a lot of publishers want to be viewed as well. It is that this cultural significance attached to what they do. And that's appealing, much as, you know, Piglet making the big Ottolenghi spread.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there any other books or writing in general where you've found how food is talked about really inspiring or interesting or illuminating?
There's a couple that I really enjoyed for what, well, one of them is particularly food centric, and that's Supper Club by Lara Williams. I think that's an example of a novel that disproves your hypothesis where the food
absolutely
is allowed to be,
yeah, I love,
yeah,
that book.
Complicated and expansive and interesting and nuanced, which I think is really wonderful. And I like The Harpy as well by Megan Hunter. I don't know if you've read that.
Oh, I haven't read that. Okay, great.
It's really interesting in domestic food and a kind of sense of putting together a more virtuous self by the way you feed your family, and also has a betrayal in it, which is interesting, the way that she fuses those together. And Eliza Clark's Boy Parts I also like for the way it talks about absence of food, maybe not talks about, but
okay,
the way it deals
with. I haven't actually
with
read that. Yeah, I've read Penance, but I haven't read Boy Parts. So,
oh,
yeah,
was Penance good? Penance is on my list. Was it a good read?
I really enjoyed it. I listened to it on audiobook, which was really interesting because I felt like it really added, because it's, you know, it's kind of like a pastiche of a true crime.
Yes, podcast, right?
Book. And yeah, and that, yes, exactly. But obviously, like, listening to it in audio really kind of,
I thought that's the way to,
I felt like brought an extra layer.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I think she's a great writer. I found it really horrible and fun.
Yeah. Yes, horrible and fun. What a vibe.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very much the Boy Parts energy as well. And if you liked Penance, I'm sure you'd like that one.
Obviously, they're very, very different books, but I can see Supper Club and Piglet maybe somehow existing in the same universe.
Oh yeah, I think
on
so.
Some level.
Yeah. They feel in conversation in a way, don't they? I feel like they'd have much to talk about.
I feel like if Piglet had found Supper Club, that would have been really good. Like, she could have
joined. What would have happened? Yeah.
Yeah.
What would have happened?
Lekker is hosted and produced by me, Lucy Dearlove. Thanks to my guest on this episode, Lottie Hazel. Piglet is out now, published by Doubleday. As part of the monthly Lekker Book Club, I'll be writing about the book over on the Lekker Substack and Patreon. I'd love to hear from you. If you've read it too, come over to the comments and let's talk about Viennetta. And I mentioned in my intro that Lottie wrote a piece for the first Lekker zine. That zine is still available to buy, and it includes contributions from so many other amazing people: Octavia Bright, Holly Gorn, Rena McQuana, Mina Miller, Rosie Daskier, and many, many more. The link to order that is in the show notes as well. And you can also get a copy of my second zine, Kitchens, if you so desire. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Before I go, one more reminder that you can sign up as a paid subscriber to support Lekka on Apple Podcasts, Patreon and Substack. Links in the show notes. And to any paid subscribers who are listening here, thanks so much for your continued support. Thanks for listening. I'll be back very soon.